This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 118, brought to you in association with Blue Motor Finance and Smart Pension. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Norris Koppel, CEO and founder of Monies, to talk about overcoming the problem of there not being such a thing as a global current account for businesses or individuals. Monies released their kind of internationally mobile, as it were, current account just over 3 years ago, and now have some 700,000 customers. Impressively, 75% of their incoming funds are salaries, and therefore they're making huge strides to becoming the primary account for their customers. Their customers obviously like them, as with 7,000 reviews on Trustpilot, Monies score 9.2 out of 10. We will come on to what an internationally mobile current account means in the show, but it's important to reiterate what Nigel Verdon said about Railsbank, or Hiroki about pull schemes, i.e. direct debits from GoCardless, around the world. Global banks are just brands, just umbrella companies, sitting over a whole bunch of national banks, all of which have different procedures around account sign-up, setup, KYC, AML, etc., etc. Despite the marketing bullshit, there are no global banks as such, just businesses that own and coordinate a plethora of local banks. This will be very familiar to any of you who have changed country and need a new bank account from your existing provider. Norris moved back in the day from Estonia to what is now a disunited kingdom and had just this problem and decided one day to set about fixing it. So how far have they got in connecting every country in the world seamlessly? How do they actually connect countries' bank accounts? Do they input one in each country in your name? How does this differ from the functionality of having, say, a Revolut or Monzo card? Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Norris. Thanks for joining me today.
Hey, Mike. Delighted to be here.
So I'm slowly collecting Baltic states, and we've had Lithuania on the show a couple of months ago, and you're the furthest east of the Baltic states. So when did you leave Estonia?
So I left country many, many years ago, about 18 years ago, but I've been back and forth building businesses here in the UK and being back occasionally with my family and so on.
And I think people know a little bit about Estonia, perhaps. So probably the main thing they know is that you and Finland and Hungary, although I'm not sure how much, share a similar and very strange language, which no one quite knows where it came from.
And Finnish also has the same. Yes. Finnish, Hungarian, and Estonian have very similar roots.
Yes. So what are the roots then? Well, nobody knows.
I don't know how you say it properly, but Hungary, Finnish roots or something like that.
Right. But nobody knows where the language or the people all came from. And
I'm sure someone knows.
Well, I've looked this up because I'm quite curious, actually, because if it was for the sake of argument, Finland, Estonia and Latvia, you go, oh, well, those people just started speaking in a funny way and carried on kind of stuff. But Estonia and Finland, I get, because you're quite close to each other, but quite how Hungary then ended up with the same family.
I have tried to speak to Hungarians and understand how their language sounds. It does sound a little bit like Estonian as well, but I'm unable to understand anything that they say.
I see.
Which is not the case with Finnish. I can understand quite well what Finnish are saying. And for Finnish language speakers or Estonians, vice versa, it's very easy to pick up our languages. But Hungarian is a little bit exceptional.
I see. So they obviously split off quite some time ago.
I guess so.
The other thing that Estonia was quite famous for some time ago, maybe it was about 20 years ago, was that they had this great idea of simplifying taxes or something like that, which is a brilliant idea, and I wish we had it over here. But then, as I recall, the last time I read about it, which is quite some time ago, which is that the politicians couldn't stop interfering and making it complicated. So where is it along the spectrum these days?
Yeah, I mean, we Estonians, we are great builders. So when Estonia broke free from USSR back in the day, 91, we had to rebuild the whole country, police system, you know, banking system, absolutely everything. And what's quite incredible is that since that time, Estonia really has come out of the sort of a Soviet Union misery and really has become one of the top countries where startups, for example, really thrive. You know, as you mentioned, simplified taxes. We have the ability, everyone in the country has an ID card, so everyone can literally log in and file their taxes in a few minutes completely online. People can also vote completely electronically online without ever leaving the house. So, yeah, we have really built up our country in the right way, I guess.
Excellent. And you mentioned the Soviet Union, which is something clearly they don't teach in America because everyone's going around, not everybody, but too many people in America going around saying socialism's wonderful and communism's wonderful and all that kind of stuff. And my ex-in-laws were all from Czechoslovakia when it was proper Czechoslovakia. And anybody with any connections to that part of the world knows not to romanticize it or to say how wonderful it was. But how long were you part of the Soviet Union? Was Estonia Estonia before it was Soviet Union Estonia?
Yeah, Estonia was Estonia definitely before, and when we were occupied, it lasted about 50 years or so. And I do remember still the time before we kind of broke free, and I remember exactly how the feeling was when you went to a shop to buy foods or anything at all, and just it was completely empty. You couldn't buy anything. So people had money, but you go to a shop, you can't buy food because there's none. You want to buy a pack of chewing gum, you know, you can't. So it was quite weird. But I must say that, for example, myself, I had a very happy childhood, like complete, you know, freedom. And in many ways, I would say that that time actually was much freer than it currently is for my kids, for example, now that we live in London.
And freer in what sense?
The ability to, as a kid, to do, there were not too many constraints. Within the country boundaries, of course, you could do pretty much whatever you wanted to, as a kid at least, I mean. But it was very difficult to go outside the country, pretty much impossible. But life inside the country was pretty good.
Yes, I've come across this phenomenon in many of my ex-Soviet Union friends, which is that although the politics was terrible, if you kept away from the politics, it didn't bother you that much. Although you may have had nothing, no one else did anyway. But actually, then within that space, it wasn't very stressed or pressed. I mean, there's this saying in Czechoslovakia, which may have been Soviet Union-wide, actually, which is, we pretend to work, they pretend to pay us. You know, so you get a cold, you take a couple of weeks off and all this kind of stuff.
Yes, exactly.
So that was more relaxing than our overstressed society. And I suspect, perhaps with the linguistic thing, it occurred to me recently, I think I saw some meme online about Orwellian sayings, to which someone had added diversity is our strength, which of course is the current mantra. But the interesting thing is that the academic research doesn't show that. So a country in a sense linguistically similar in a way to Estonia, but not the same family, is Iceland, which is 99.8% Icelandic. And I remember there that my client, the daughter was 4 years old and school was 2 miles away. And at the age of four, she would walk 2 miles to school, and it never crossed their mind that there was any worries. You would not do that in London to your kid.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I talked about, you know, what I mentioned about the general happiness and happiness levels and freedom and so on. You know, there were so many restrictions in place. For example, I remember when my father wanted to buy a car, we had money and all that, but you couldn't actually buy a car. You had to put yourself in the queue and wait for permission to be given. And when you got one, then you can actually buy a car. The same with having a telephone. So people waited for years to get a telephone line installed because it had to be signed off by someone in the government and so on.
Yes, and we need to move on. But I think the irony of that is that from an economic perspective, it was a producer-driven economy. It was all around the producers, not the consumers. But I find that the irony in the West, as it used to be called, the irony in the West these days is that we live in a very corporatist world where the large corporations, the huge banks, et cetera, tend to rule the roost. So we're going back into a kind of producer economy. And Mikhail Gorbachev, of course, he was very instrumental in actually moving on from the USSR. I think he said the biggest surprise of his post-presidential life was that in West Europe, they've started to recreate the Soviet Union in terms of a central bureaucratic organization ruling the roost over here. But let's move on from politics. So, okay, so you had your idyllic childhood, and then, like all of our childhoods, that came to an end. So why one day did you get up and move out of Estonia and come to this crazy country? I mean, maybe at the time London seemed okay, but it's now all over. We're finished.
So, I mean, what I love about Estonia, and it's such a tiny and small country, so if you are building a business that is just trying to sell something to fellow Estonians, you're unlikely to succeed.
Population is
1.3 million people, so it's really nothing. Sometimes I joke that you take the entire country of Estonia, you bring this all these people to London, and you drop them in somewhere, and you know no Londoner will ever even notice that another million has been added. So it's the entire country. So after breaking free from Soviets and all that, and country being such a small place, I mean, what I really love is that so many people needed to really think outside the box. And when people started creating businesses and startups really took off, we were almost forced from day one to think globally because you can't really sell anything inside the country. And I guess this also brings me to the UK. I saw that I don't want to be a citizen of just one country or stay there. I wanted to embrace the world. So my mother happened to move to the UK and invited me over. So I came to visit, liked it, and stayed.
Before a student or after a student?
That was after my student episode, yeah. So yeah, I came here. That was around, year was 2000 or so. I worked for a marketing company as a sort of a front-end developer and really enjoyed life. Salary was good, pay was good. But at some point in 2007, I really wanted to start doing something myself. I had little money saved away and I wanted to really see if there is any business opportunities for me. And I kicked things off. I started a business in the UK, which was focused on providing credit services. And we chose a very difficult business area. So we tried to focus on this customer segment that is typically underserved. And we wanted to give customers quick credit as quickly as possible. Back in the day, in 2007, money moved about 3 working days between UK banks. So we made money move in about 15 minutes. So that was quite brilliant. And we were able to issue funds to consumers even during the weekends, which was great. Anyway, moving on. 2013, I had just sold my last business, tech business, and I was having a holiday in Florida with my family for a few months and started thinking about new things that really moves me and makes me tick, and came up with the idea of Moniz. And how Moniz, the initial thought, how that was formed was that I really wanted to build something that is truly globally scalable. And we all know that building a financial services product or a bank that truly is globally scalable, it's incredibly challenging, almost naive and impossible to pull off that. But this was my thinking at the time. And also as a nomad or international moving to the UK, I happened to experience the pain of being outside the system, coming from the outside. So I couldn't even open a simple bank account at one of the major UK banks, which was quite kind of ridiculous.
Yes, you get stuck in these catch-22s. They ask you for your rental agreement or something, but you can't rent anything unless you've got a bank account and all that kind of stuff. And my elder daughter did some ranching in the States in the summer, and she was paid for it, and she spent ages in America, somewhere in the Midwest, trying to get a bank account. So the problem is there. So just sort of keeping it very simple basis to start off with, we can make it more complicated later. Having been around Southeast Asia for 3 weeks recently, big recommendations if anyone wants to go to Hanoi, by the way, super cool place. I didn't need a bank account to be there for 3 weeks, and I suspect that I could have carried on with my MasterCards and Revolut and Monzos and all that kind of stuff for 3 months and not needed a bank account. So in, I was about to say the modern world, but it's probably been the case since about the 60s or 70s with credit cards. So what do you actually need a bank account for if you've got one already? So if you've got one of these pieces of plastic from an app-only bank, why do you need a bank account? I mean, if I'm flitting backwards and forwards to Berlin, shall we say, and doing the Berlin FinTech podcast, I'm sure they have good ones over there. I wouldn't need a bank account in Berlin. So what are the kind of watersheds? What are the dividing lines that mean that people need bank account in certain countries?
I guess if you are going on a holiday and you have a bank account in your home country and you're just spending the money that you have in that bank account and you have a card that is connected to that bank account and you're going on a holiday, then you don't obviously need a new bank account in that country. But situation is quite radically different if you go to that new country and you aim to start a new life there and you need to receive a salary. It is very difficult to get salary from, let's say, Vietnam to your UK bank account. No one wants to pay those salaries and take FX fees and so on. So you kind of need to have a local bank account wherever you go to live on a permanent basis.
Right. So thinking about what I would do if I happened to be in Berlin tomorrow and trying to build them over there. Well, actually, I can talk about a country nearer to home. I did a gig for a nice company in Latvia a couple of Christmases ago, and I sent them my invoice and said thank you very much, and once I recovered from that terrible hangover from their Latvian hospitality, which was tremendous, and they transferred money in all these funny complicated IBAN things that I never quite understand or remember into my HSBC London FinTech Podcast bank account. So you're really talking about if you're living somewhere then at a certain point in time it gets convenient or necessary to open a bank account. I'll give an example that last week John Godwall was on the show from Landbay a couple of weeks ago, and he was saying what they do is when the new people move over to the UK, they give them a Revolut card and they just use that for a while and then they open a bank account.
Yeah, I mean, for us the question I guess is that if someone needs to receive salary, not you know, self-employed or small business is also a different story, but if someone truly flies over to the UK, gets a job at, I don't know, Tesco for example, you kind of need a UK local bank account. account, you need to receive salary, set up direct debits, and use this as your main account. And this is what we have built Moniz for, to make it super easy.
I see. And there are certain things, I mean, I can't think of them all off the top of my head, but I think there's certain things, probably like the tax authorities, HMRC, who would insist on paying you into a bank account or out of a bank account. And certainly if you've got a business, it's the same thing there, that in the UK, to pay VAT, you will probably need a bank account for that reason. Okay, so working in a country is one of the things, and living in it is one of the things that means that, although of course you can survive for a few weeks on your credit cards or debit cards elsewhere, at a certain point in time, you need a bank account. And at that point, you run into the challenge that you run into, which is that it's not easy to get bank accounts in different countries.
Yeah, absolutely correct. And there are multiple scenarios where people would need a bank account in a new country. Let's imagine a scenario where, for example, you know, lots of British people, they go to Spain, or historically used to go to Spain, and they make a new life there, they retire there, but they kind of have a life still going on in the UK, and they have a new life now in Spain. Historically, you needed two banks. You needed a Spanish bank and you needed the UK bank. And it was super expensive to move money and difficult and, you know, lots of paperwork required. So we're taking that barrier away. We are giving customers a single app and they can manage their money in both countries simultaneously. Let's imagine a situation where you have your, not just your whatever, direct debits going on, some income, a pension, for example. You can also manage your any mortgages and credit and whatnot in the future through a single interface in both countries.
I see. So let's take the case then that I move to Spain, the weather's certainly better, and politics are probably better, and I open an account with Moniz today. It takes you however long it takes to open an account for me, and you do your KYC, AML checks, all that kind of stuff, and then my account is active in the UK. And then I move to Spain, and as you say, it's all through one app, I get that bit. But behind the scenes, under the bonnet, what is actually happening? Will you open a bank account in my name over here, in Moniz's name, or HSBC's, or some provider? Or will you open one in Spain? What are the mechanics of it?
This is where it becomes quite tricky. So what we try to do is we try to hide all that complexity from customers, make it super easy on the surface. But how it all fits together, as I said, it's pretty complicated. So the way we operate is that in every country where we operate,
and that's how many countries now?
So right now we are in 20 countries already. So in European Economic Area, or let's call it Eurozone at the moment, we are able to operate under a single license right now because of Europe. Post-Brexit.
If we have a Brexit.
Yes, we would need a UK license and European license. And then it's all about how you put this thing together. So it's a little bit like a Lego. You would need to be connected to banking infrastructure in those countries. SEPA system in Europe, for example, faster payment system here in the UK. You have to have a system. You have to become a card issuer, for example, in order to issue those MasterCards that we currently do. So someone needs to be the one issuing those current accounts or European IBANs, for example. So how we operate is that we want to own as much technology and control as we need to in order to operate. But it doesn't make sense to build a complete bank in each single country because I'm going to die old before I can actually pull it off.
Exactly. So and Moniz is a bank in the UK?
Moniz is not a bank. We aim to replicate bank-like experience without being
a bank. Are you an EMI, electronic money?
We are regulated and we work with other companies who are regulated as e-money or EMI companies.
Which is like Revolut or an e-money.
I believe they are,
They're
yes.
applying for a banking license.
Yes, yes, correct. So what we do, it doesn't actually require a bank license. That's the beauty of it.
Yes.
So we can issue accounts, cards, payments. We can replicate the whole bank experience.
So if I set up Moniz account today, I put £100 in it. It's not sitting with Moniz Limited, but you pass it on to presumably something like NatWest or whatever, who will keep a pot of all the money of all your UK current accounts.
So typically, the money would be on Moniz Limited's pooled account at a mainstream bank in the UK and Europe and beyond. And the way it also works is that typically the underlying bank is not controlling whose funds are ultimately on that account. We own that information and we control and we segregate those funds and the bank safeguards those funds. I would also like to point out that those of you who think that, probably these funds are not protected and is my money safe and so on, I would say that actually I'd like to believe in an extra safety net almost. So EMIs are by law required to hold 100% of customer funds in a reliable, strong European British bank, which means that if something happens to Moniz, 100% of customer funds would be returned, not just £85,000.
Yes. So the e-money issuer is like a bank. Just stick to the UK for the moment. That you can give us, you'll give me a sort code, you'll give me a whatever account number and stuff like that and a piece of plastic, which is called a card. So you can give me all of those things, but the principal difference here is that, unlike a bank, you don't hold the money, but that's held at a large institution. So in the case then, expanding that to where I'm also moving to Spain and living in Spain and getting pensions or something like that, presumably you then need to have a similar structure, which is that you're allowed to issue Spanish bank sort codes and account numbers, basically, or whatever they call them in Spanish.
Yeah, correct. So for us, it's a key thing to control two things. So first of all, we needed to control KYC, or know your customer process, and anti-money laundering checks and all that aspect that basically separates bad guys from accessing monies. We needed to build that completely on our own, so we couldn't be relying on banks' KYC, because otherwise if we work with so many banks, the process is going to be hugely challenging to make sure that everyone is happy. So we need to own KYC, which we have done. We spent actually years before we launched focusing on technologies that makes international KYC accessible in real time. So we are able to onboard, we are able to help people who are coming from US, Vietnam, anywhere, Ukraine, you name it. We are able to help them where other banks can't, and there is no paperwork required. So thanks to technology. That's one. And second thing that we also need to control, because we truly have a global ambition. So how do you build a global banking service? You cannot rely on existing off-the-shelf technology, really, because it's not built to be scalable that way. So we needed to build a bank core that kind of holds the whole thing together. So it holds together our relationship with the UK banks and beyond. It also is the smartest system in the food chain, because we are ultimately controlling where the money is at any given moment and where it flows. So these two pieces of technology really help us to be who we are and how we support our scalability.
Okay, so the method we're talking about, which is similar to Rails Bank and Go Cardless, at the big picture at least, is in essence the brute force approach. Because the way that the world exists, there are national banks in each of these countries. You either become a national bank yourself in Finland, for the sake of argument, and in Canada, or you have to work with a Finnish bank or a Canadian bank if your customers want to be able to open accounts there. By being this e-money issuer, you sit on top of them. You, in a sense, white label their commodity products. And I assume that in your app, let's say you're in Canada one day, that I download your app, I've got your app, and you've got sort of, this is Mike's account, this is your UK sort code and account number, Mike. This is your Finnish sort code account number, Mike. This is your Canadian sort code account number, Mike. So that, let's say, for the sake of argument, I happen to need bank accounts in those countries. Is that how it works?
Yeah, this is precisely how it works. So the idea is that once you have downloaded the app and opened an account, you have Moniz ID. You're within Moniz ecosystem, and what you do there is up to you. With a single tap, you can open a UK account. Another tap, you have a European one. You can, with a third tap, you can order a card. And in the future, as we expand beyond 20 countries, again, with a single tap, you can open an account in the US, for example, and so on. It doesn't matter that your funds are held with, let's say, Chase or Bank of America. We hide that complexity away from you again. For end user, this will be Moniz as an ultimate holder of customer funds and so on.
I see. So I'm slightly reminded of the conversation with Barclaycard, where I was talking on the podcast about what is a credit card when you no longer need a piece of plastic. And I think actually my Revolut app will do a virtual credit card. Well, why do we call it credit card? What actually is it? And in the same way, you're creating these, apparently creating bank account numbers for me, which certainly work in the bank system, et cetera, but hidden away behind that is a Spanish bank or a Canadian bank or an American bank, and I don't need to know. So let me say, for the sake of argument, I've got $1,000 in the UK, $1,000 in Spain, $1,000 in Finland, and $1,000 in Canada. Does that get shown as different amounts? Because although you say that correctly, that I just care about how much I've got, actually, it does matter how much I've got in a Canadian bank, for example, because let's say my Canadian business has to pay an invoice. Well, that will come out of my Canadian bank account. How does it work having multiple accounts?
Think of Moniz as sort of a smart guy in your pocket almost. So you can combine, you can bring all your money into the platform. The way you get money in or out, it's almost irrelevant. You as a customer, you want the best possible and cheapest way that you can imagine in order to manage your money in an easy way. In a single app, you can see what sits where, in what currency. You can swap it between currencies and accounts in a convenient way. And, as I said, there is almost not important if there is an account number attached to it or a card. Again, you as a customer should really be in control of that. So if you need an account in Canada to control your Canadian dollar funds, then you open one and you send money out or get it in. It should be really as simple as that. So we shouldn't be too focused on just the account numbers or how these are issued. But I'm saying that, you know, that you need a place where you hold your funds that is aware of you, your behavior as a customer, how you transact. You know, if you're a good payer of mortgage repayments or not, how do you consume your credit card? How do you use your credit card? And that's what we are building.
Yes. Okay. And I was more focusing on the account balances. You know, what's my Canadian dollar account balance? I don't know, Finland uses euro or something. But anyway, maybe other countries like Greece don't. Actually, Greece does, famously, silly me. Right. Okay. So I've got that, which is that you're gradually expanding the network of countries in which, in effect, if I need a bank account, I can get a bank account pretty quickly if I'm a Moneys customer already. And of course, in the UK, as we know, current accounts have been free for quite a long time, which is what's challenging the other app-only banks, which is that if you turn up and ask for money, people are less likely to come to you. So you've got a problem if you just stick to the UK. Now, I presume, given what you're talking about, is far easier to say than do. Going around opening bank accounts all over the world and having all these relationships, as I know from Wells Bank, as we know from GoCardless, no doubt you, it's easier said than done. It's very quick to say it. It's much harder to actually make it all happen in all these countries and open these new countries and that kind of thing. So your challenge of producing revenues, of monetizing this, must presumably be far harder than in a single country. So what's your business model to make sure that you're just not being a charity and helping everyone and this is really nice and everyone's really happy, but you go bankrupt unless the VCs keep pouring the money on the top?
From day one, we wanted to make sure that we build a sustainable business and we're not just relying on venture capital money. So what we launched with was a product that had a monthly fee. By the way, it was hugely successful, believe it or not. But since then, we have introduced further pricing packages. You can start with a free package. You can also pay if you wish. The difference between the free and the paid for packages, on a free package, there is no monthly fees. But for example, if you send money abroad, the FX rate is slightly higher. If you pay a monthly fee, you can effectively kill all the other fees. So those people who are heavy users, they use their card abroad a lot or they send money, they do a lot of transactions, so then it makes perfect sense to pay a monthly fee because it ends up being incredibly cheap, actually.
Yes. I mean, one of the vocabularies, and I came across this recently in Thailand and in Vietnam, actually, one of the vocabularies that app-only banks use is that we're transparent, we don't have hidden fees and all that kind of stuff. That's very good, so I'll tick that box. Anyway, I was having a problem in Thailand because all the ATMs in Thailand charge you a fixed fee or something, 2.5% just to use them, which is the local bank will take it. So it's nothing to do with any of the banks. And I think I maxed out my free Monzo allowance. And then I happened to find by chance that Revolut have got the most complicated process imaginable for countries like Thailand and Vietnam to do with UTC trading hours and blah, blah, blah. So basically, to cut a long story short, if you go to an ATM in Thailand or Vietnam on Saturday night with your Revolut card, they, for the sake of argument, add something like 2.5% to what it would be otherwise. But if it's trading hours in London market, which is, you know, you lose track when you've got jet lag, what bloody trading hours in London market, you go to sort of a different rate. So I think one of the challenges as banks scale internationally to more and more obscure places, which are harder to deal in, and I've heard enough Americans complaining about the problems of the American banking system. So even in the sort of very first world countries like that, being transparent is fine, but being simple and clear,
yeah, that's
is always, easier
always
said
the
than done.
Part. That's very true. So yeah, it's a balance. You know, if you want to build a sustainable business, how do you ensure that you are pricing the product in a way that it doesn't scare customers away, it feels fair and transparent? It's a massive challenge, not just for us, but everyone, I guess. But what we ultimately wanted to achieve was that we wanted to get to unit economic level profitability, meaning that whenever a customer does a transaction, then doesn't end up costing us tons of money. And so we wanted to ensure that we find that balance. Unit economics are sound and make sense. And then once that has been achieved, we wanted to ensure that by adding other things that customers would really want from a banking service, such as, you know, I don't know, credit, mortgages, savings, and all these things, that we add these on top. And effectively, if we are able to monetize from these new revenue sources, then ultimately we can drop some of the underlying fees completely, ultimately making sure that customers, we reduce the cost always. So effectively, we have done some things that some other companies have done differently. So instead of coming to the market with a completely free offering and then switching gradually on all sorts of fees, we went in hard with a fee that sounded expensive at the time, and now we're gradually turning the fees down.
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? And that's how the world changes. And certainly I picked up my Monzo card when it was a couple of years ago or something, and it was all very free. And then there's lots of social pressure in Monzo, like, oh, you're using too many ATMs a month. You know, that's not very good to the community, blah, blah, blah. And then it's followed by a limit. And then a more recent one, which is why I ended up getting the Revolut card, actually, was that Monzo said, oh, it's expensive if people top up using debit card, which is all I ever did. I don't have a salary anyway in my kind of life. So there are the two ways, which is, you say, you set up, and actually from day one, you're not going to go bust with the economics, you may not make any profit. Or you set up on day one and you give it all away, but you're going to drown very rapidly, and then you've got the problem of trying to row back. So very briefly then, because we'll talk about monies in a second, how long is it taking you to roll out to new countries? So you're in Europe and UK at the moment, 20 countries or something. What's next on the list, and how many months does that take?
Yeah, so launching was tricky initially to get going in the UK. Took us quite some time. Launching in Europe took us much less time. So in European Economic Area, which is about 30 countries or so, we actually went live in a few short months, and that's a pretty huge geographical coverage. Now, as we go to new territories, we estimate that every country is obviously different, but we should be able to launch in a new territory anything between 6 to 12 months or so.
Again, it's not a lot different from what Hiroki was saying a few years back. It shows exactly the challenges of dealing with banks abroad. And do you have a sort of 2019 wish list of countries that you want to be in, or game plan?
Our strategy is not to do them one by one, but going into multiple jurisdictions at the same time. And therefore, we believe that by doing this, we're actually able to scale pretty rapidly, because we're still sort of going through various stages of deciding which country is best. So I'm not going to name any countries at the moment.
Right. Okay. So you're being coy on that one, but listeners can find out where you turn up in. And as far as I know, there are not many people who are trying to do this internationalization, giving people the option of having bank accounts in the countries as well as a piece of plastic. So that's very fascinating. And before we wrap up the show, I'd just like to thank all the listeners out there in all the various countries. And if you're near Hanoi, as I say, check out the coffee shops. I went to one that had 165 five-star reviews out of five stars, which is amazing. And I went to the best cocktail bar I've ever been to as well. So it's a phenomenal place. Also, you can drink egg coffee, which sounds disgusting, but actually it's pretty amazing. And I'd also like to thank my brand partners of the podcast, Blue Motor Finance, who are, according to the 2018 FT1000, the fastest growing FS business in Europe. Blue's award-winning technology has supported over $1 billion of lending, working with over 3,700 UK motor retailers. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrollment.co.uk. Okay, so we've heard a bit about monies as we went along, and largely that's because the main course topic about how, shall we say, a new co tomorrow could set up and create an international bank account itself really has a limited number of approaches. And as we've heard with Rails Bank, and as we've heard with Go Cardless, the main one that everyone goes down is the brute force approach, which ends up having banking partnerships around the world and then wrapping that up for your customer. So is there anything you want to tell us about monies, and then otherwise for the many listeners out there who should be checking you out right away?
Any new fintechs who want to build a banking service that is truly scalable and so on, I mean, it's not an easy task. You really need to focus on something. So right now, when the fintech boom started a few years ago, I mean, it was very difficult to understand who is going in what direction. Many people seem to be doing exactly the same things, but right now I would say the dust that is settling in the space. It's very clear who is doing what, and any new entrants really need to find their own calling, their niche, their focus, and so on. So I would really focus on that. It doesn't almost matter how you get going and how you put systems together. The important thing is to get going and find your focus, and everything else can come a little bit later. I would also say that in a financial services space, the focus on KYC and anti-money laundering aspects and ensuring that no bad money enters your platform is incredibly important. You know, the world is watching. Fintech is still new. There hasn't been anything happening to date yet, but something will happen somewhere. So we just need to be ready and be cautious. And, you know, bad stuff happens to big banks all the time. It's just a matter of time when it happens to small ones as well. So you need to be prepared and make sure your systems are solid. And I would say that's the most important thing. For a consumer, if you move abroad, if you have lives going on in multiple countries, if you have your mother, father abroad, you have your mortgages going on in multiple countries, it just makes sense to check out Monese as well. It's truly built for those people who move around, who don't want to stay in one country for their whole lives. Provides really easy and efficient way of dealing with your finances. Ultimately, it's built to be a smart guy in your pocket, you know, just knowing where you are and how you live. Monis is growing incredibly fast at the moment, so we are adding about 30 people each month to our team right now. We're currently about 200 people across four countries. Our head office is in the UK, and we just opened an office in Portugal and also Berlin, and one of the biggest teams is back in Estonia as well, customer support and back-end development. So we are really, really aiming to hire great talent, and so if you want to check us out, monis.com is the address.
Excellent. Well, you've just moved into Finsbury Square, which is becoming a little app bank corner, because you must only be a sort of, oh, I don't know, about a five iron away from Monzo, who are a sort of pitching wedge away from Starling Bank. So you could actually sort of hit a lot of app banks around here. And you certainly, in all my years of going around fintech land, have won the ratio of large office and empty number of desks to number of staff at the moment. So you're planning ahead in terms of floor space for all these staff coming along. And as you said, and many other people have said the same, and all three of you are very good entrepreneurs between Rails Bank, GoCardless and yourselves, it's not a trivial matter to open in another country. You know, I can say, oh, why don't you do America? That seems like a good idea. You say, yeah, sure. But it's easier said than done. And I think that, you know, this is a clear example of where you're meeting a real need, because in the modern world, people are mobile. And given how the politics and Brexit stuff is going over here, then I'm probably tossing up between turning Swiss and turning Vietnamese. In 2019, I'll have to check out, which is easier. And as and when you add those countries, then I shall definitely be downloading you and hopefully moving out and becoming the Hanoi FinTech podcast, or maybe the Hanoi Cocktail podcast. That sounds like a...
I would also actually like to challenge you a little bit. So you said that, for example, only if you move to Vietnam and beyond, then you would check out Monis. But right now, if you're banking with one of the big banks, I would say that maybe try the app right now and see if it's any better. I would argue that not only is the account opening speed fast and convenient, no paperwork and so on, once you're inside the app, what you see is the much better way to manage your money. Let's say you go on a holiday in Vietnam or somewhere else. Instead of signing up with multiple fintechs in order to get better FX rates and whatnot, you can just stay within Monis, and we will give you everything that you need. And we know about where how you consume. You can manage your money in an easier way. Keep an eye on your spending habits and all that. So it's just definitely worth a try.
Which makes me remember that one thing I haven't emphasized, which I think is true, which is that we have been talking about consumers and people, but actually you do business accounts, actually, as well as consumer accounts.
We do. We recently opened our small business account as well. So again, the same way, with a few minutes, you can sign up, and your account application typically is approved really quickly. And one thing that I didn't mention before also is that we operate already in 11 languages, which is pretty rare, meaning that those people who don't speak English language, for example, speak, let's say, German or Spanish, they can use the product in their own native languages. So it feels like coming home.
Excellent. Right, that's impressive stuff. Well, I should probably check you out on the business account, because I'm more unhappy with my business account than I am with my ancient intelligent finance account. And I wish you every success in the future. And I wonder how many countries you're going to get to one day, but no doubt all will be revealed. So thank you very much, that Norris.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory / non-exec, or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, with the faces so grey, with the pain of the everyday. mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight dance.